We are honored to be joined by President Jimmy Carter. Thank you, Mr. President, for joining us.
Al, I'm delighted to be joining you and also to have you in Atlanta.
I was at the Carter Center yesterday and spoke there by the way, congratulations on having the number one book. And I, as someone who is now paying attention very closely to the bestseller list, I'm a little angry at you.
Well, we were delighted to have you at the Carter Center. I was disturbed. All my children were there, and instead of buying my book, they were buying yours.
I know. They were saying that, and they were buying mine. You know, mine makes a great gift, as does yours, but they were buying them for Christmas presents, and I went like, you know, your dad's got one out.
Well, that's true. Well, it's good to be competing with you.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book, and it's a great topic, our endangered values. And in it, you write about, you are a man of faith, and you have applied that faith in a way that is so, you know, so admirable. And I started last night by responding to a Rush Limbaugh thing where he says, you know, name one country where Jimmy Carter has helped people. And then I ticked off, you know, the 40 countries where you've helped people. And I will say also, when I was writing this by your kids, they knew everything. They knew about every disease, and they are so admiring of their dad, as we all are.
Al, I have a question. Who is Rush Limbaugh?
I'm sorry?
Who is Rush Limbaugh?
He is a guy who helps millions of people every day fool themselves. So, in your book, you address fundamentalism. Because when I say you're a man of faith and the way you've applied your faith, you have, when you talk about values and you make a distinction in religion and you talk about fundamentalism.
Yes.
Could you talk about that?
Well, this is my 20th book, and it's the first book I've ever written, you know, about political issues of the day. The rest of the books have been poetry and novels and things of that kind. But I have become so intensely concerned in the last 5 years about two major trends in our country and their merger that I decided finally to write this book. I describe fundamentalism as one of the root causes of the problem, but also one of the results. And in religious circles, as I define in my book on just one page, fundamentalists are always men, the leaders. They always consider themselves to be superior. They feel an overwhelming inclination to dominate other people, particularly women. They subjugate women to men and make them subservient to their husbands. They consider themselves to be uniquely related to God and endowed with insights that other human beings of an inferior nature don't have. Therefore, they have to be 100% right. Anyone who disagrees with them, therefore, is got to be wrong. And the next step is inferior. And it's impossible for them ever to admit that they have ever made a mistake, and they consider it to be a violation of their principles if they negotiate or mediate or compromise or cooperate with people who differ from them. And so this has been the case in extremes in both Christianity and in Islam and in other religions, but it also spills over, you notice, some of those characteristics into the political realm. And I think that's the fundamentalist inclination that has now permeated politics in Washington has been one of the major causes of dramatic changes in what used to be a harmonious and relatively cooperative attitude among Democrats and Republicans and between Democrats and Republicans. Now it's I am right, you are wrong, therefore we cannot cooperate attitude. And as you know, in in top circles in our country, you're either with us or against us, and there's no way to reach out and form a cooperative team. And so that is the essence of fundamentalism. And unfortunately, in the last 5 years or so, we've seen an increasing inclination for the ultra-right, sometimes fundamentalists, in the religious circles to combine their efforts and to form alliances with the ultra-right or fundamentalist circles in politics. And this has broken down what I consider to be a historic and even religious characteristic of America. I happen to be a Christian, as you pointed out. Jesus taught, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. And Thomas Jefferson said we must build a wall between the church and state. Well, in the last few years, that wall has been deliberately broken down, not secretly, but ostentatiously and openly. And so these are some of the things that have caused me concern, and they've led to a series of other basic political changes in our country.
Talk to the distinction. You talked about the separation of church and state,
yes,
which I'm a firm believer in, but the distinction between that and the fact that religion and faith has informed political movements in very helpful ways. In abolitionists, in Martin Luther King, of course, was
sure,
a reverend. So talk to that distinction.
Well, I consider myself to be a traditional evangelical Christian, and I realize that every person who goes into any realm of life, whether it be a radio announcer or a farmer or a submarine officer or a professor or whatever, takes into his daily life the basic elements of moral values and ethical principles that had been derived during his earlier years. Those are quite often inherited. Sometimes they are taught by parents or family members or peer groups or others. Sometimes they are based on a particular religious faith. But whatever they are, they shape the basic inclinations of a person. And, of course, it's almost impossible to imagine that that person wouldn't apply those principles if he or she is elected to public office. And they include usually the most admirable elements of all religions, that is, a belief in justice, a belief in peace, a belief in service to others, the alleviation of suffering. Those kind of things obviously are attributes of any human being, and you can exhibit those in a political office without trying to let one particular religion be exalted in politics, or without letting political elections be shaped by any particular religious group, particularly in a democracy. So the administration of or the implementation of your own religious or other ethical or moral values is natural for a human being in any realm of life, to repeat myself and summarize, but to weld the two so that they influence one another to the preference of a particular political party or a particular religious faith in a democracy is what I deplore.
And you said that the wall has been broken down,
yes,
ostentatiously.
Yeah.
Talk about that for are you talking about the faith-based initiatives, or
the faith-based initiative is one element of it. In fact, last year, as I described in my book, about $2 billion of taxpayers' money was channeled into primarily Christian churches for the benefit of believers in the Christian faith. And this is unprecedented in our country. As you know, there was a big debate going on primarily in Republican Party circles about whether those funds, which are taxpayers' monies, could be distributed, would have to be distributed on a non-discriminatory basis, that is, equally to Christians and to non-Christians. And the decision was made, no, it's legal and proper under this administration to distribute them with primary emphasis on the benefit of fellow Christians. That kind of thing has never been done before in this nation. And it's one of the several radical departures from previous historic political policies that I described at some length in the book.
Okay, we're going to take a break, Mr. President.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll pick up with the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. We're coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. President, it's, as you say, your first overtly political book that you've written of the 20 you've written. Let me ask you on this issue of values. Where have Democrats missed it, or have they? And I believe, listening to you and then listening and thinking about the Bush administration and Ralph Reed and people like that, we should be able to win on values.
Well, in the first place, we did win in the year 2000, and we shouldn't forget that. And secondly, I think the 2004 election was highly skewed because the public opinion polls show, Al, that about 8 or 9% of Americans maintain that in a time of so-called war, they are inclined to support the incumbent president, even if they disagree with his policies or his politics, since he's the commander-in-chief in charge of the young men and women who have endangered their lives overseas. So I think the 2004 election was highly skewed by the fact that Americans were convinced that we were at war and that our daily existence was threatened and that we were constantly in danger and we were being protected from the White House. And I think that that is an aberrational aspect that shaped the election in 2004. So it hadn't been a matter of values. It's been a matter of a lack of ability to present our points of view accurately, and that's one of the reasons I wrote my book. I might add hastily, though, that I don't consider our endangered values on American moral crisis to be a book about Democrats versus Republicans or about liberals versus conservatives and so forth. What I consider to be of great concern to me is the radical changes that have been made in this administration compared to all previous administrations, and that would include George Bush Sr., it would include Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, Dwight Eisenhower, and other Republican and Democratic presidents. And these changes of an unprecedented nature have been made in some of what I consider to be our nation's basic moral values. One is peace. I happen to worship the Prince of Peace. I don't worship the Prince of Preemptive War. And when the president has announced that we have a new, unprecedented, basic policy in our country of going to war with another country, not just when our own security has been directly threatened, but if we don't like the leader of another country, or we think that sometimes in the near distant future our security might be threatened, we have a right to bomb them, to launch missiles against them, to invade the country. That's a radical and very disturbing new basic moral value that's established as an American political policy. Another thing that concerns me very much is our almost total abandonment of being the nation that raises high the banner of human rights. We have abandoned the championship of human rights. It's inconceivable to me that we would now be arguing about whether America has a right to forego all commitments to previous international agreements that we ourselves led in working out, to insist that our CIA and others, the military as well, has a right to torture prisoners who are helpless and captive by us. As a matter of fact, as you know, the Second World War, the Great War, was permeated by horrible human rights violations, the most notable of which, obviously, was Hitler's persecution of Jews in the Holocaust. These were helpless people who were tortured and executed when they were captives. And I had my own favorite uncle, Tom Gordy, who was captured by the Japanese 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. He was on the island of Guam, and he was tortured for 4 years. As a result of that, the United States took the lead in going to Geneva and honing down in a very precise way a prohibition against the torture of prisoners who were taken in a time of war. We now have abandoned that. I think that's a basic moral value. And that's become a matter of professed public policy with the vice president and the president.
Mr. President, we're going to have to go, but I want